We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 9, Harry Meets Dracula. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I talk with Dr. Beatrice Groves about allusions to the novel Dracula in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today's topic, Emily, is Harry Meets Dracula, and we're going to be talking about some of the creepy common elements in the Harry Potter series and Bram Stoker's famous novel, Dracula. Emily, when you think of supernatural villain types, which ones are the most terrifying to you?
Well, there are a lot of people who know this about me, but I am a no zombies zone. So, like, I basically put up this front of just being annoyed by them. But the fact of the matter is, I just really want nothing to do with that idea in my brain of the undead coming to eat your brains. I don't know even what they do. I kind of keep myself away from it because I'm just like, I can't do it. And then when she went and put them in book 6 with the Inferi, I was like, no. But it was very scary for me.
Yeah.
I appreciated the thrill factor.
Yeah, the decaying corpse part of that I find pretty grotesque. Yeah. Zombies are they're psychologically very interesting manifestation of like our fear of death and all of that.
But because they're kind of barely sentient, you know,
yes.
Like there's some sentience there, but it's like it's too much.
And so I did not go for zombies, although I thought about that one, because zombies are kind of dumb at some level, you know, there's some ability to outsmart them. And although I felt like it was a little bit of a cop-out, I basically ended up with vampires. I have a definite distaste for vampires. It's all the blood and the drinking of the blood and but also the smartness of the vampires, you know, that they can seduce and hypnotize victims.
Right.
But also similar to the zombie, the kind of corpse-like waxy bodies.
Yeah.
And immortality. Emily, I find immortality really gross. There's something really gross about very, very old beings like that. Wandering
That's a good
around.
Sign about you, Katie.
Yeah.
If you're repelled
not
by
into
the
it.
Immortality, you've read Harry Potter well.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, so vampires, they're kind of rough and brutal, and especially Dracula. I mean, obviously he sets the bar, but they're capable of elegance and sophistication. There's that high class quality of the Count.
Yeah.
And that's such a kind of peculiar combination that makes them feel just really sinister to me. So I am right in with this topic today. And I did find, Emily, as you and I were trying to read Dracula before this episode, Dracula is a straight up good book. I understand why.
Yeah.
This is a good read. And so to our We're probably not going to spoil things for you too much because Dracula is already very much out there. But I would recommend people read Bram Stoker's book if you haven't already, because it was definitely a page turner and definitely stuff where I was like yelling stuff to the characters out loud sitting in my living room.
There's a lot of that, although I sometimes think that's me as a modern reader yelling back at
Yes.
some of what's going on in this text
Yeah,
that's
we know
very.
quite a bit more about vampires. We can anticipate some of the stuff that these people who they've never seen a vampire, they don't know what they're talking
Right.
about. Yeah, so we are going to get right into our topic today, which is connecting Dracula and which is this most famous of vampire novels. It creates this whole genre of vampire novels, and Harry Potter, which does not have a lot of literal vampires in it. But has these a lot of actually really interesting connections. And our special guest who is going to lead us through this discussion is Dr. Beatrice Groves, fellow and tutor at Oxford University and author of the wonderful book Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. And I reference that book all the time. Always going back. I'm
Same.
sure B has something to say about this. Her MuggleNet blog is Batilda's Notebook, and she also blogs at Leaky Cauldron. Listeners, you can follow her on Twitter. And so, welcome back to Potterversity, B.
Thank you, Katie and Emily. Lovely to be here.
Harry Potter, like the book Dracula, has gothic elements. So we're going to start with like the setting, and sort of, I definitely felt like the mood of Dracula. That's set especially at the beginning when we're sort of in Transylvania, it does evoke some of the scenes in Harry Potter. So, what are some of the similarities in the way the environment is described in the two novels that gives us that, kind of creepy chill?
Yeah, so it's this castle, really, isn't it? I think that's the when Rowling talks about Hogwarts, she says the first thing, when, after the sort of Harry walking into her mind is that she imagined a castle, a huge, creepy gothic edifice, and that's absolutely where you go towards in Dracula, and I suppose a sort of 19th century gothic in both cases. You've got a sort of medieval sense of a great past behind. But it's actually something quite Victorian in both cases rather than truly medieval, I'd say.
That's interesting. And I thought I was thinking about how, they steer away muggles at Hogwarts because it just looks like it's a ruin. And Jonathan Harker's first impression of the Count's castle is that it's just a ruin and there's nobody there.
That's a really good one. Yeah, that's a really good one. I like that. It's funny, I'm just completely change of of mood, but I was just writing a blog for MuggleNet about Towel Day, about Douglas Adams and Harry Potter links yesterday, for the 20, because the 25th of May is Towel Day, and I hadn't thought about that, but of course that's one that he has a sort of version of Muggle repelling thing where when people approach this thing you don't want them to know about, they suddenly remember they've left the oven on and they have to rush away. As well as the brilliant someone else's problem field, where you just can't see this thing because it's got a somebody else's problem field around it. And I think that's like the Rowling takes both the sort of comic element of the Adams thing and then also the gothic element of the Dracula one, and brings both, you get both sort of senses with Hogwarts.
And
But
the
yeah.
ruin part gives you that sense that there's some sort of ancient history there that is still kind of with us in the present, right?
Right, that impression of depth.
Yeah, and I also just, this is sort of related, but we don't find this out too much later in the novel, but it says that Dracula was a soldier, a statesman, and an alchemist, which latter was the highest development of the science knowledge of his time. So that again, going back to sort of medieval science, and so in Dracula himself, he of course has that same turning out to be, rather older than he should be, reaching back to again this link between the medieval and the sort of Victorian sciences. I think it's rather fun.
Yeah. And I was also really struck by the way Eastern Europe is portrayed in the first part of, well, and the last part of Dracula. Eastern Europe as this place that's like barely on the edge of civilization. It's not urbanized. And, you got all this superstition. And there's this sense that, evil is very rich in this area. I felt like there was a kind of connection there between the way that J.K. Rowling, you know,
with Durmstrang, and I suppose with Durmstrang also, it's yes, not Durmstrang. A particular place, is it? It's mm-hmm. again, it's unknown. Nobody actually knows where Durmstrang is. So you're right. It's in a mythical. You get the sense that it's sort of Eastern Europe, but also clearly north because they're all furs. You know, it's clearly somewhere mm-hmm. cold. But I think I agree. A sort of mythical sense of a part of Europe stroke Russia that you just don't you haven't been to, and a not very modern sense of geography, shall we say, in both cases.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think it is an interesting it's an interesting Gothic element, you know, with the Gothic, you're sort of thinking, where am I going to put the Gothic? Anne Radcliffe likes to do that with Italy. and I sort of think that maybe, you know, as we're getting farther into the 19th century, Eastern Europe is maybe playing a similar role. And I was also struck by I'm always interested in the politics of it, but, you know, there's this suggestion that the Count is a very tyrannical master. He's, mm-hmm. you know, he's high class, but these people, they have to obey him. And you've got that legacy of serfdom that lasts for so much longer in Eastern Europe. And I think that has some connections with the way that J.K. Rowling, you know, puts her villains as people who are basically would be tyrants and who bring slaves or, you know, basically serfs around them to do their bidding. And
yeah. And there's this sort of, obviously we know there's obviously lots of other sort of issues and things with the house elves, but that sense that the pureblood families all come with house elves, that they have sort of right. that serfdom is built into the pureblood families only. But you have a family at the Weasleys, which is totally pure. They've gone back all this time, and there's obviously no sense that they've ever had a house elf.
Right.
So you're like, what's the system there? You know, mm-hmm. so you've got to have a big house as well as be pureblood or something.
I think that's really interesting, too, because I think of the Weasleys as being, I mean, they're like the hobbits of the Harry Potter series, right. in the sense that they're supposed to be, you know, more earthy and grounded and pragmatic
and wholesome.
And they kind of represent, I believe, that like sturdy English character.
Mm-hmm.
Voldemort spends the years in between his supposed death after the Avada Kedavra curse on baby Harry. He spends those years between that and Harry's arrival at Hogwarts, hanging out, not in Transylvania, but in Albania, another Eastern European country. And that's where he meets and takes over Quirrell, like inhabiting part of Quirrell. And that's how he makes his way back west, right?
And of course, there's a nice, so we were mentioning earlier that there aren't very many literal vampire references, and that is one of them, isn't it? So one of the only ones is that Quirrell has a putatively garlic-filled turban. They're like, they say that's what it's full of. So that is really nice that he actually had a sort of vampire meeting. That there's two others, I think, which is the Sanguini and then the blood-flavored lollipops. Taste section of Honeydukes. So the sense that vampires are around and buying sweets in mm-hmm. Honeydukes. which might
Gross.
Be ideal. But I was just thinking how blood-related most of the vampire references are. They aren't about mirrors, you know, not having reflections or all these other mm-hmm. options. But the other one is the garlic with Quirrell. So yeah, I really like the fact that Quirrell has in fact had his Count Dracula Albania meeting, and say if he only had filled his turban with garlic, things might have turned out better.
Yeah, and then of course Quirrell becomes a bloodsucker, and that's one of the things that's one of the first times we see this. We don't know it's Quirrell at the time, but that he's sucking the blood of the unicorn as a way to, you know, stay alive or gain immortality.
And he does move. You know, I always, when people say, "Oh, that's Quirrell," I was like, "It is Quirrell," but it's also, I like the name, you know, people call him Quirrell Mort at that point. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good name because he's not just Quirrell at that point. It's like he moves strangely, you know, he's suddenly, you know, and I think that's a very vampire movement where they suddenly just appear beside you and they've made no noise. And Quirrell isn't normally like that in the daylight hours. You know, it's only in the nighttime when he's sucking the blood of the unicorn that he gets, sort of, as it were, more fully inhabited by Voldemort.
Yeah, and I kept trying to trying to make a Jonathan Harker Quirrell reference, but Jonathan Harker never he's trying to escape the whole time. Like he doesn't actually end up possessed, but he is sort of the instrument through which Count Dracula is able to come over to England, because he's the lawyer who like gets him all the stuff he needs to get over there. And so I thought there's some kind of a parallel there.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think Jonathan Harker, because we're seeing it all from his perspective, he can never feel very Quirrell-like, because Quirrell always has to be on the edge for us. Though I think the sort of, obviously you would think more naturally perhaps Jonathan Harker is the Harry, because it's from his perspective, but actually it's sort of Mina Harker who's Harry. And that's a point John Granger made in his bookshelf, Harry Potter's bookshelf book, about the way in which Harry is much more like Gothic heroines. He's always, when you look for his parallels in Gothic novels, they're always female. And I think that's, you know, absolutely correct. So he's like, you know, he's got lots of Jane Eyre aspects to him, and he's got Mina Harker aspects to him. So yeah, Jonathan Harker isn't Harry either. So things don't match up quite as one might expect, even though Voldemort is clearly Dracula. but of course, although that is, you know, Voldemort is Dracula, the person who fandom has long thought was a vampire is Snape.
Right.
So there's this other vampire figure. And Rowling's always, you know, absolutely gone completely anti this. And then she did admit a little while ago there was I don't know if either of you have seen it, the History of Magic BBC film to accompany the History of Magic exhibition. Did you get to see that in the States?
Yeah.
And she does, and then show, I think, on that the... She says, all these years I've been saying, oh, no, Snape's not a vampire. And then I realised when I drew this picture of him that he looks exactly like a vampire. And it's a picture, you know, before she wrote Harry Potter, one of her early sketches when she's sketching to help her think about the characters. And he's got this, you know, great big black cloak going up behind his head, and he's swooping with no feet. And you're like, yeah, he looks completely like a vampire. So it's quite funny. It's like it's one of those things where she's, no, I'm definitely not doing this. And then the other hand is, you know, doing it. And I love that line in Goblet of Fire when Harry says, you know, not unless he can turn himself into a bat or something. And Ron says, you know, I wouldn't put it past him of Snape.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, you know, if you're trying not to tell people he's a vampire, then that's like, if he can turn into a bat, it's like the most Dracula thing possible.
She's exploiting the metaphor,
exactly,
is what you're
exactly.
saying.
And just, you know, getting, so he's always sweeping around in this long black cloak. And there's the bit in Half-Blood Prince where he's like looking just as much like an overgrown bat as ever. So she's absolutely sort of pushing this button. Well, it literally can't be true, because obviously we do see him in the daylight. So he, you know, he referees that Quidditch match in the broad daylight, for example. And maybe some of that was the sort of misdirect away from how much Voldemort is like a vampire and how crucial. So I think the most important Dracula links all come in the final novel. So quite possibly she was keeping that vampire idea alive, but misdirecting it to Snape, so that the incredibly close blood connections, the scar connection, and the Horcrux connection, which are all to do with Voldemort and Harry's connection.
So one of the things that I thought was very vampire-like actually was in the movie when Snape and McGonagall duel, and then Snape, you know, vanishes and
flies out the window. Yeah,
very bat-like
too. It is, you know, if he jumps from a window and then flies, that is what the Count does. So he comes in through the window and flies out, and it's, you know, sort of between human and bat. So I think although they may have extended that in the film, it's definitely in the novel as well. But there's also the first little tricksy one, which is when Neville and Harry are discussing their essay about vampires, and you know, Neville says, you know, don't get the garlic at all, do they have to eat it or something? And then Snape just appears just as he's saying that. And I also wondered, you know, the fact that Snape has set the werewolf homework in order to get them to realise that Lupin's a werewolf, and Lupin sort of scotches that homework and then sets them instead vampire homework. And you think back, so, you know, it's the revenge homework. It's like, well, I don't want you to realise I'm a werewolf. Why don't we all realise that Snape's a vampire? So it's quite funny. And Seamus Finnegan, who has that correct question, do you remember at the very beginning, he says of the Baron, I wonder how he got covered in blood, which is, sounds just like this ghoulish question, but actually it's the right question. We actually should be finding out about the Bloody Baron. Also wonders at some point, you know, maybe we'll get a dark arts teacher who's a vampire. And then of course they do get Snape as a vampire. I would have thought this dark arts teacher. But so again, one of those little Seamus asks the right questions moment. You think, oh, she's just done loads of little nudges in this situation. Once you start looking for them, it's quite surprising. And of course, all that darkness in the potions classroom, he covers the windows up.
The conquest of death, you know, just the idea. Yeah.
Absolutely. And when he changes classrooms, he doesn't. You know, it turns out that he makes the new one all dark as well. You sort of think, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I think that's part of Snape's appeal to people, you know, as... I think he's more appealing when he's Alan Rickman, but even in the book, there is some kind of appeal to him because of, you know, there's a kind of elegance to Snape, you know, although we find out that he actually did have a rough upbringing, but he seems kind of elevated, and part of that is, you know, he seems to have a lot of knowledge and a lot of knowledge of things that are, you know, arcane and with these potions, and that seems to me to court some of the same qualities as Dracula.
And obviously that gothic, the Byronic brooding anti-hero. Yes. You know, that's what we've got there, and she's definitely playing on that with Snape.
Right.
And I think, you know, obviously one of the appeal for Dracula at the time was how sexual it is without, you know, anyone kind of admitting that's what's going on. But the vampire brides, and the fact that, you know, when he does bite them, they actually sort of want to give in to him. So I think that sort of, so some of the Snape appeal that people have gone for has been about this, a sort of a bad boy image, and dark and brooding and mysterious, and as you say, knowing everything, the way he is so good at occlumency, so he can just look into your eyes and know everything.
Yes.
And then you can't read him at all. These black eyes that are completely opaque.
Yeah, and that's definitely, you get the sense that Count Dracula, like, he knows, you know, he can predict what you're going to do. And there is that similar idea that, you know, and yet you don't know what's going on with him. Yeah, I find that persuasive. There aren't a lot of literal vampires in Harry Potter. So we do have, as you mentioned, there's Sanguini, but he's kind of funny. He's kind of,
he's very funny. I love that, like, have a pasty bit when he's like eyeing up the girls.
Yeah.
And also he's quite clever metaphorically, because of course Warple, who is his sort of handler, as it were, is Rowling's, you know, outrage against what she sees as sort of vampiric obsession on her creation. So this idea of this person coming in and saying, oh, Harry, everyone wants to hear your story and I can make loads of money from selling stuff about you. And I think that's very much Warple as you know, as a vampiric character himself. So it's kind of cool that he's got this funny, sanguine side.
Yeah, and of course the sang part of that is blood, right? That's French for blood, and sanguine, and all of those, you know, all of those kind of bloody references.
Vaguely Italian sounding.
Yes.
And it is, you know, there's also this, so sanguine is a personality type from the humours, so this idea that your body's made up from the four humours, and you know, loads of stuff is going on sort of quite subtly in Harry Potter about that. The most obvious one is phlegm, actually giving that name to Fleur, so she gets one of the other body types, so sanguine and phlegmatic are two of those body types from humours. So just it's nice that she brings in the word sanguini there.
Now she said that, I guess there was some idea at the very beginning when she was thinking about the series that she had a plan for a vampire teacher named Torkar or something like that, but it was quickly scrapped. And she, you know, I guess she went with Snape instead.
He's that, but that's nice to feel there's a hinterland of him behind why Snape seems so vampiric.
It seems like she has to have, because, obviously, Voldemort is more the more overtly, if metaphorically, vampiric character, but Snape is the one who's in the castle for the whole series, and so it feels like she has to have this character who's positioned in this gothic castle, who is exhibiting all these metaphorical qualities, obviously.
Yeah, and that he can be appealing, She doesn't want anybody fancying Voldemort, and he would be really weird. Yeah, exactly. If you're completely insane, that's fine. But I think that's why it's nice to have the sort of the gothic anti-hero thing into someone who she does actually want you to have some sympathy for, and that it is, it turns out to be all about love for Snape. So he has, there's a Heathcliffian side to him and all that kind of
stuff. I did go down a little rabbit hole with Snape wives. I don't know if you've encountered this, the idea that there was a Snape religion, that I guess they were fans of the series, but they felt as though Snape was just a representation of some real, like, ancient idea of Snape. And there are these particularly women who felt that, I guess, they could channel him. It was very, very interesting.
We just went
but
off the cliff.
I know.
It was
Snape wives, and it's very interesting. And I guess it fell apart. It was like a part of the fandom, but I felt like there was a sort of vampiric appeal to Snape that was, kind of locked up in this, like a fantasy of this connection. But like I say, like you said, off a cliff. So
can't Google fast enough.
So how about, though, let's talk a little bit more about Dracula and Voldemort, because that's Snape has villainous qualities, but he is not Voldemort. He's not the one who's, pursuing immortality and the real parasite. So what are some of the connections or some of the, I guess, qualities of Dracula that Rowling has put into Voldemort?
So one simple one is the red eyes. That's something you see, it's sort of the sunset covers having the rosy glow when he first bites Lucy, and she says, his red eyes again. And Mina, when she sort of wakes, remembers a vague memory of something long and dark with red eyes. And again, when we discover people have seen him around London, they say, oh, we saw this strange bloke with red eyes. So that sense, and Rowling, I think, uses Voldemort's red eyes really well, in that we see them getting redder when we go back to being Riddle. There's a bit where he first starts killing people, where the eyes start going red, there's sort of a ruddy gleam, it's not huge, and then as time goes past, they go really red. Early in Dracula, Harker notices a red light of triumph in Dracula's eyes, and it was kind of fun reading that because it reminded me of that really important moment in Goblet of Fire when Harry sees a light of triumph in Dumbledore's eyes when Voldemort has taken Harry's blood, and the reader realises there's something crucial about that, but we don't find out what that actually is till the end. And when Dracula takes Mina's blood, it gives him a mental connection with her. And he says, you will come to my call now. When my brain says, come to you, you shall cross land and sea to me. And the connection that is forged by blood between Dracula and Mina is very close to the Horcrux scar connection that Harry and Voldemort have. So it's not... What's sort of slightly odd is I think like she's remembered it and twisted it either consciously or unconsciously, but they both have a scar connection. So Mina gets a scar on her forehead after Dracula has done this to her, because they touch the host to sort of see what's happened. It's like, oh no, she turns red at the touch of her host, very much like Quirrell not being able to touch the skin of Harry because he's so pure while he's Voldemort. She gets the scar when she's touched by a host. But the scar isn't the connection between Dracula and Mina. It's the blood that's the sort of the telepathic connection. Whereas, although there is this important blood connection between Harry and Voldemort, which will enable Harry's survival, the telepathic connection is done through the scar. But the telepathic connection is incredibly close because the telepathic connection is beneficial to Voldemort and Dracula, but then is used against them at the end. Mm-hmm. So they hunt down Dracula through Mina knowing where he is, just as that final bit when Hermione says to Harry finally, you know, no, go into his head, find out where he is, you know. So until then they'd be really fighting against that, but finally it is useful to Harry to hunt down Voldemort via that telepathic mm-hmm. connection.
Yeah, so, it's a power, yeah. But it's also a liability exactly. for the vampire figure.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's so interesting, the idea that you can understand and you can defeat evil better when you have had that kind of contact with it or that vulnerability to it. Sort of an interesting idea.
Yeah, it is interesting. And both Mina and Harry sort of are harmed by it. And I think they have the same, you know, that revulsion to book five, when Harry fears that he's sort of unclean and wants to run away from them. And Mina's like that too. But when they sort of accept it as possibly a power, it's partly their sort of sacrificial goodness that they're willing to use this for the benefit of the others, that it can then become a power. If they don't get taken over by it, it can be useful. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. It's definitely one of the things that I think reason people find Dracula interesting today is that sort of that sense that there isn't as clean a line as one might like between evil and good, say. So there's people mm-hmm. who are definitely good and there's people who are definitely evil, but there's then this sort of messy interchange.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's very interested by.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's one of the, I mean, there are so many things about Dracula that permit multiple interpretations, you know, but I think that's what we like about Harry Potter too. Of course, one of the things that I would say, and you sort of mentioned this before, connects Dracula to Voldemort are these things that these external objects that seem to keep them alive. And for Dracula, it's these boxes of clay or earth?
Soil, yes. Sort of homeland soil, mm-hmm. Which he has to, yes, it has to be from Transylvania, the soil, and kept mm-hmm. in these boxes. This just entirely randomly, but I really like the way that this used to happen with monarchies who are exiled, that you would then, if the next king of that monarchy was born, you would take a box of soil from the homeland and put it under the bed so that he was still born in his homeland, even though he was in exile. So this is really similar to this. Then no
yes.
doubt they wouldn't have really liked the vampire link. But I just thought that is, you know, Bram Stoker's not making up some sort of sense that you can kind of bring your homeland with you just by putting it in a box. But absolutely, that's so like the Horcruxes, because he has 50 of them and they've got to hunt them down. So they go, you know, the band of friends find out about boxes and they've got to find them all and hunt them down and destroy each one. But it's also really like the Horcruxes because he's kept safe by them. But you can nonetheless sort of destroy them without him knowing about them. And so he becomes suspicious. The moment he becomes suspicious that they're hunting him down, he then goes and checks where he's put them. And that's exactly the same
yes.
as at the end when suddenly Voldemort realizes. And the question is he going to check them in the right order? So they have the same thing of thinking, which one will he check first and which one does he think is the safest? It was very, very close to that moment where suddenly you get that rush when how if he goes to check the Hogwarts one first, then everything is a disaster. It's only because he goes and checks a different one first that it can work.
And buys them time.
Yeah,
And I was sort of interested in the, you know, the Horcruxes. I always think about how the locket has this very negative effect on the on Harry, Hermione, and Ron when they have to wear it. That there's something malevolent even in proximity to the Horcrux itself. And it struck me that there was something kind of like that in Dracula as well, where there's this, you know, if you're too close or too many interactions with this, I think about Lucy's decline and just feeling terrible. And it's like being under that, under that dark cloud that both of them seem to bring with them through these material objects.
There's also, I felt, a real connection between Lucy, the vampire bride, who has to be killed by the person who loves her, and the riddle Hermione when she comes out of the locket as this incredibly... Do you remember, she's more sexy and more terrible than the real Hermione. And Ron has to stab the locket and kill her. And the same thing happens with the vampire bride Lucy, where a sort of a nightmare of Lucy, as it calls her, she's all sort of voluptuous, she's bloodstained, voluptuous mouth. And so that new sexiness, which, you know, we can obviously worry about the sort of Victorian male thing where a woman who is sexy is obviously being taken over by a vampire. She could just like enjoy her own sexuality. That's like the worst thing possible. But it does follow through with the sexy Hermione who torments Ron.
Wow, that's cool. Mm-hmm. What a great connection. Wow.
I was really pleased with that. And in fact, I sort of then had a look at the same moment, and there's some actual sort of, I think, links of words there with the blood spurting out of it and the thing sort of writhing in the costume, and that happens with both with the locket and also with the killing of the book, when the blood sort of stabs the book and the blood goes everywhere. It's quite similar to that. That moment again. So you wouldn't at the time when you see him stabbing the book through the heart with the sharp thing, you're not thinking stakes and vampires, but when you know about the Horcrux vampire connection by the end, you think, oh yeah, that is actually quite put a stake through the heart of the vampire.
Yeah, and I thought the death of Dracula and the death of Voldemort had some similarities in sort of the way it was represented, the earthy quality. I guess Dracula turns to ashes or something like that. The movie kind of is a little more like that, but just the falling thud of the body, I think has a, you know, like I say, it's, there's something very, like that ashes to ashes, dust to dust idea.
Yeah. I was struck by the time thing. So I've always been interested by the fact that Voldemort's killed at daybreak. So the moment the sun comes into the remember, it's sort of purple gold and the sun suddenly breaks into the hall, and that is the moment at which he dies, and I think there's some harrowing of hell imagery going on with that. But
definitely,
I did also say, I think this one, the vampire can't survive at daybreak. If you keep him up till dawn, you can kill him that way as well. So that did that bit. It was a nice little sort of vampiric moment about his death.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've been critical of the way the film portrays his death, because I like the mundanity of his death in the book, in terms of he falls to the ground and he's dead, and he's dead just like anybody else, you know, would be dead. Mm. But the film does sort of make the crumble to dust imagery, draws that out. And you know, I have to maybe give it a little bit more credit for being elusive.
Well, it makes
the Dracula
sense
story.
As well, doesn't it, that, you know, Dracula's such a major thing for film, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it makes sense. Perhaps the films would be, you know, would notice and play up the vampire side of it.
And, you know, Dracula, I guess, comes from dragon, which I guess Bram Stoker was reading some folklore or something, and also, like, dragon, but also the devil, I guess, was in some of these regions, dragon and devil were seen as like, it's like the same linguistically. And I think the snake-like qualities of Voldemort, and, you know, dragons are not exactly snakes, but there's like a connection there.
No, they are absolutely. So I've written a bit about that on a blog about the History of Magic exhibition on Leaky Cauldron, about the snake-dragon connection. So the dragon constellation after which Draco is named mm-hmm. is a snake. If you look at that constellation, it's just mm-hmm. a long snake. And so it's one of the dragons who guarded the golden apples of the Hesperides, and they're snakes. So there's a Greek, basically in the Greek, dragon and snake are not really divided. And it's sort of later, they come down to different words in English, but they are totally connected ideas.
The marks on people's necks that look like, you know, that's obviously like a snake bite type thing, mm-hmm. you know, for and Dracula.
Again, you know, sometimes with Snape, things happen the opposite way that you expect. So that's how Snape dies. So his name, Severus Snape, sever his nape, makes him into the Dracula. But actually, right. that's how he dies, is with a snake bite on his neck.
Right.
So it's actually his ending, not who he is. And a number of those things happen. You think, you know, it's like you think that Harry is going to get beheaded by all those things, and then it's not actually, it's the snake that gets beheaded. But yeah, I think that's a nice inversion of all those Dracula things she's been feeding us with Snape's death.
Yeah, and then Neville killing Nagini. I mean, I don't know if there's any similarity there to Quincy. Quincy is this American. So if you haven't read Dracula, there are these three men who fall in love with Lucy, who then Lucy becomes she's steadily drained of her blood by Dracula, and then crosses over to become a vampire herself. And these three men are the ones who end up being the hunters, along with Jonathan and Mina. And one of her lovers is this American, Quincy, who's a kind of aw shucks Texan. Mm-hmm. And he actually does not survive the book. So I've just spoiled that for you. But I just wonder if there's any kind of Neville Quincy
I had Quincy more, again, a sort of slightly surprising Snape thing, because they name the baby. So yes. Mina and Jonathan have a baby, and they name him Quincy. So again, that sort of naming of Albus Severus, because Albus is definitely Van Helsing. So there's a massive Van Helsing Dumbledore thing. So I think that the naming the baby Quincy reminds me of, Snape's.
And of course, Lucy doesn't choose Quincy, so he's also lovelorn.
So he's the person who's in love with the unrequited lover who nonetheless sacrifices his life and then gets a baby, you know, the new knife named after him.
Okay, that's better than my Neville connection. I was trying to get Neville in there somewhere.
I know, you always I want Neville always. Sometimes. But just thinking about the Dumbledore Van Helsing one, so the thing, there's one of those which is just obviously that these are the two guys in charge, telling everyone else what to do, not really explaining to them why they're doing what they're doing in this unhelpful manner. But there's also a nice link with the author in both cases. So that sort of authorial control, which obviously some readers, and we're definitely feeling that now with Rowling, sort of object to. But the author themselves rather likes, obviously, this authorial type character within the narrative who's in charge. And identifies with them. And both Rowling and Bram Stoker have done this quite strikingly with their central character. So Rowling often puts what she calls personal passwords into her novels. And there's loads of real life connections, which I'm sure lots of our listeners will know about. And with Dumbledore, she doesn't put a sort of obvious link like that. But she said, he's the person who I most feel like, she said, it's like automatic writing Dumbledore. He's the one who's like inside me, and he understands things about me. She says, you know, when I don't know, I think it till I see Dumbledore say it. Then when he says it, I think, oh yes, that is what I think, you know. So Dumbledore is very much the authorial avatar. And Van Helsing, I think most people don't notice this, but he's got Bram Stoker's name. So Bram is actually a shortening of Abraham.
Oh.
And he's Abraham Van Helsing. It's quite a striking thing to give, you know, Abraham's not a common name, so to give this character your name Abraham is a very strong personal password to put in there, I think.
Huh. Yeah, and both of them, both Dumbledore and Van Helsing, they know so much more than what they are saying. And it's not that they, I mean, I think in both cases, they find themselves in these situations that they're trying to navigate through. They don't necessarily have all the answers, but they know a lot more that they keep to themselves very frustratingly. And of course, that's another kind of authorial yes. thing, like there's exactly. a manipulative element to both of them. And you're like, oh, Van Helsing, just tell them why they have to have garlic in the room so her mom doesn't take it all out.
There's no plot if they do. You know, if the author just splurged everything in the first page, you know, the reader, we want them to tell us, but actually we don't really
We wanted to unravel before us.
But they don't tell the other characters either, you know?
I'm with you with the garlic. You're like, just tell them. But then, yeah.
Label it as anti-vampire.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's this sense at which both of them figure out, oh, I guess I should really tell you a little bit more about what we're doing here, what we're all collectively trying to do. I've just asked you to trust me for a really long time, and you've done well, and so now I'll reveal everything to you.
Obviously, spiritually for Harry, it does, I think, you know, there's obviously a wider thing going on where he has to sort of learn to trust, and only when he learns to trust can he make the sacrifice. So she never explains why he needs not to know he might not come back to life. And I think that's one of the incredibly sort of Christic things about Harry's death mm-hmm. is that it's clearly important that he doesn't know he might come back to life. And if that's important, then he has to trust Dumbledore, you know, more than just Dumbledore saying, you know, you're going to die and that's just that. You know, there's somehow it needs to be the fact that he doesn't know that probably won't happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's her thinking about sort of faith in a more general sense of just, you know, Harry having to learn to just trust.
Right. It's about intention, right? Because and the deepest magic in her universe is about, it's not just about precision. It's about intention. It's about the state of your heart, you know.
Exactly. You know, and he says,
magic.
Exactly. I meant to die. And Dumbledore says, you know, that will have made all the difference. And it's never explained why that should make all the difference. Because as you say, it's just, you know, it's a Lewis style deep magic. Because we've got sort of literal magical reasons to do with blood infusion and Horcruxes and becoming masters of death and all these sort of literal magical things that could be the reason he comes back to life. But that's not what Dumbledore says is important. He says what's important is that you intended to die.
Right. Yeah. So also you pointed out, B, the Hand of Glory is a connection.
It's a connection that is easy to miss, but Dracula is set very much in Whitby. So Whitby is where Dracula comes, makes landfall to England. And Whitby, the real place, Whitby is full of Dracula stuff. Now, if you go and visit, it's got masses of Dracula attractions, and there's a museum, the Whitby Museum, which has a Hand of Glory in it. And I didn't realize this before, but it's the only Hand of Glory that actually survives, or at least supposed one that survives. So it's quite likely, I think, that Rowling may have seen that actual one, and that's why she thinks about the Hand of Glory. I didn't realize, you know, when she said, she says in an interview, you know, Hands of Glory are real things, but actually it turns out there's only one real one. So I do wonder if we see a trip to Whitby sometime in her past that may have both interested her in Dracula and triggered off that Hand of Glory.
And what is the Hand of Glory supposed to do? How does it function as a magical object?
It's supposed to be, the real Hand of
the
Glory.
The real one, yeah.
So it's sort of meant to be a pickled right hand of a felon cut off while the body's still on the gallows and used by burglars. It's not actually, so obviously we know in Harry Potter it's lighting only to the person who owns it. That's not what it does in the real one. It sends everyone else into a coma. So burglars enter the house and everyone else is slept. So it is, there's something to do with a candle. So there is a sort of clenched hand becomes a candle holder, but that one doesn't exist. The Whitby hand is outstretched. And so some people in that version, the fingers light up. And should one of the fingers refuse to light, that means somebody's still awake. It's full on, isn't it?
I have to laugh at it. It's grim.
It's
like overkill. You really have to send them into a coma to do what you need to do.
I'm sure coma doesn't mean they don't like come out. It just means like they just won't wake up while you're burgling there.
Yeah, but that's like Dracula too, and the that's how they get in the house. They basically they drug the servants. So everybody falls asleep and.
There's a nice thing, just another sort of wider Harry Potter connection with that moment when Dracula comes off the ship at Whitby, which is that he comes as a great big black dog. Like the Grim, and in fact the word Grim is used. So Bram Stoker used a book called A Glossary of Words, used in the neighbourhood of Whitby, to try and give literal accuracy to some of the speech of the people around Whitby. So I don't have a good Whitby accent, so apologies to any listeners who knows how this should sound. But this is the old man when they ask him about the dog, and he says bar guests and bogles and all unto them only fit to set bairns and dizzy women a beldering, and they and all grims and signs and warnings be all invented by parsons and illsome book bodies. So that word grim is there in Dracula, of the big black dog, who this guy is saying, oh, he's just a grim, which is just a made up thing. But actually, as we know, it is real. And it's also quite like Sirius, because you remember when Sirius says he pretends to be a lovable stray, and when he's the black dog. Mm-hmm. It happens in Whitby that he's sort of mistaken for a lovable stray around Whitby. So there's a menacing aspect to the great black dog, but there's also the people just think he's just this nice black dog and don't realise that he's actually Dracula in disguise.
And is a harbinger of death as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But as with the Grim, not because another kind of death is coming, but in this case, because the dog's going to kill you. So it still fits with the idea that the actual idea of a death omen is not quite right.
I thought that was the most terrifying part of the novel. It was the account of the ship and the crossing and the captain who's, everybody's dropping like flies, everybody's disappearing, and then all of a sudden, it's his turn next.
That was freaky.
It's very spooky, isn't it? And ships are very good for that. That sort of isolated sense.
I was really grossed out by this insane asylum character in Dracula, Renfield, who likes to eat flies, and then he'll nurture the flies and then get some spiders and feed the flies to the spiders, and then he's very interested in the kind of gruesome
I'm so glad no one gave him a cat.
Yeah, and I was wondering, and he talks about when Dracula has come, he is soothed more because he feels like his master has arrived. And it made me sort of think about Peter Pettigrew with Voldemort.
I thought the same as that. Yeah. Renfield is quite a different, he's much more spooky than Peter Pettigrew, but absolutely that sense that he is helped by someone, that Voldemort needs this, quite
servant.
Yeah. Not a very powerful person in and of himself, but if he is allowed to go to the Voldemort Dracula figure, then he will be much helped by that.
A kind of slavish devotion to this.
It was a figure. Sort of in between. Was I felt like it's quite Bellatrix as well. So he had the sort of obsession of Bellatrix and the that sort of all quasi-sexual thing, but with a sort of Peter Pettigrew side to him as well. Yeah,
useful but expendable.
And that's based there. You can go and visit that. That's near Whitby, the lunatic asylum that Renfield is based on. So yeah, he did sort of go and do some research from real Victoria.
Creepy.
Yeah. So there's a real creepiness behind that one.
Yeah, and I was thinking about in terms of thematic connections too. There's that feeling that you have this deep past that has a lot of darkness in it, that yet keeps manifesting in a present that tries to be more sanitized, modern, you know, rational, and yet you keep having this thing that's mystical and deeply evil, and you know, connected in with things that are both you know, supernatural, but also very much of the earth, that keep kind of being resurrected, even as we try to build our modern industrial society. It just struck me as similar, and you know, in the two. So, did today's episode make you thirsty?
Definitely did me.
Perhaps
also slightly creeped out.
I know.
Maybe in need of a mental relaxation.
Well, one of the things I noticed at the beginning of Dracula was all of the thirstiness references. He's eating a lot of spicy food, and I was like, "Oh, that's so funny. They make you feel thirsty at the, you know, he makes you feel thirsty at the beginning of the novel." So if you are feeling a little thirsty, you may need to satisfy your craving with a Potter potable from our mixologist Emily. So let's head over for our special segment to the Three Broomsticks for a Vampire Cocktail.
It's happy hour at the Three Broomsticks.
Well, Madame Rosemarta here. That's my alter ego when I'm in my Potter mixologist mode. So, you know, we were throwing a lot of ideas around for cocktails, and the one that I just couldn't get away from was, of course, the Sanguini Martini. I do love martinis. So I would suggest for the Sanguini Martini, one option would be to sort of transform a Bloody Mary into a martini. That's kind of a fun way of reinventing a drink. So you could put vodka and strained very cold tomato juice, or if you really are anti-tomato juice, which I have to confess I am, you could use some sort of reddish or pinkish tropical juice cocktail. And you could or could not include, especially with tomato juice, this would be good, a couple dashes of hot sauce, Worcestershire sauce, or both. And you want to shake those over ice in a cocktail shaker, just as you would a martini, and pour those into a pre-chilled martini glass. I think it would be fun, especially for our theme of vampires, to dice some garlic, and just before you serve it, to sort of toss the garlic across the glass, the top of the glass, so that you have this nice presentation. Of course, you could also have speared cloves of garlic and Spanish olives as a garnish for this drink too. So that is our first version of the Sanguini Martini.
That sounds good.
What do you think? Is that up your alley, Katie?
Yeah, with the tomato juice. Yeah, I like that. That sounds good.
That?
Okay. Yeah, I'm you know, it's too bad there aren't like Transylvanian olives that you could go to your
local you know, international market and see what you can find.
All right.
I'm all for that. I like where your head's at. If you think the idea of tomato juice and garlic in a cocktail is more repulsive than, I don't know, people eating flies, then I would suggest you do take a totally different tack for a different kind of martini. So there's this liqueur called Lillet Rouge. So this relies on that. I think Lillet Blanc is more popular, but Lillet Rouge is also available. So it's a deep red wine-based liqueur. And so I would start by muddling some Bing cherries in a cocktail shaker, okay? So then you want to add ice and maybe an ounce of gin and maybe 3 ounces of Lillet Rouge. You could throw in some orange bitters if you have them on hand. And then you're going to shake that over ice and, again, pour into a chilled martini glass. And leaving the stems on, you could garnish with a couple more Bing cherries. So that would be a slightly sweeter. You could even probably throw in some sugar syrup if you wanted it even sweeter than that. So that's going to be a little sweeter version of a martini-type beverage that may be a more appealing to certain.
Yeah, I have a sweet tooth. That one sounds really good to me. Yum.
Yeah, sounded good to me.
With the cherries, and there's all kinds of, you know, because of the, I don't know, cherries very, very seductive, you know.
And yeah, they are.
So I like that as our vampire cocktail. Another Sanguini Martini. Wonderful.
That's the one I'd like to try. Yeah, I think my husband would like the above. And speaking of my husband, he had a great idea for this next drink. So this is a threefer for.
Okay. Yeah. Three different options.
And we will go ahead and post these at MuggleNet, so you can check them out yourself with the ingredients and all the amounts and everything. So, but this final one is, and again, we're playing on the sanguine terminology here going on. So this is Sanguini's Sangria Surprise. Okay, so it's really not that surprising in that it's really just a basic red wine sangria recipe. We've got apples and oranges. We've got a little bit of brown sugar. You muddle those in a pitcher and then you add a cup of orange juice. I would add a half cup of Pimm's, Pimm's Cup, which is a British product, which is very good. Then you want to muddle that some more. And then add a bottle of fruity dry red wine and a cup of ice and stir that in gently. And the surprise is you can garnish it with a garlic scape. Wouldn't that be good? So garlic scapes are these long kind of curly stems that come up from the garlic plant and they eventually flower, but you want to cut them off before they flower. And that sends energy down to the plant so that it'll grow into a garlic clove and you can harvest it, you know, in the fall or whatever. So this is my husband, my farmer husband's idea. So to garnish it with that garlic scape, which has a really mild garlic flavor. So I'm not sure if it even gives off much of an aroma at all, maybe a little bit. So it wouldn't affect the flavors too much.
It's a thematic garnish.
It's thematic, right? And it's more for the dramatic. They're very, you know, they're very long and they're very curly at the end. And I think it would make a really excellent garnish. And you could garnish just the pitcher or you could garnish each glass with a little bit of a garlic scape when you serve it. You want to serve it in a glass with ice. So that is Sanguini's Sangria Surprise. And of course, the surprise is on Sanguini because you can drink it while still being protected with that garlic scape. So,
and I was going to ask you about one of the things that you said, which is you talked about muddling some of the ingredients. I'm not a yes. mixologist. Can you explain what it is to muddle something?
Muddle. It sounds like muggle, doesn't it? It sounds a bit like, yeah. Muddling is just, you take like, I mean, if you didn't have a, if you have a mortar and pestle, that's a good way. I mean, a mortar and pestle, you're muddling things in the, you know, you're kind of breaking up spices and things like that. But muddling in a cocktail shaker, you could use a wooden spoon. So you're just kind of mashing them up, but you're not like trying to get them pureed. You're just kind of releasing the flavors when you muddle something.
Okay. All right. Very good. I've just been, you know, grading student essays. So I'm thinking of a different kind of muddle.
You're muddled a bit more. Your brain has been a bit muddled by those essays.
So B, do any of those cocktails sound good to you?
I'm not a drinker,
okay.
Oh. So yeah, just keep away. But I like very much the idea of a sanguine martini that he wouldn't be able to drink because of the garlic. I think that's what makes you
Jokes on you, Sanguini.
All right. Well, we hope you all listeners will try out one of these. And if you do, let us know. Let us know how it goes. Send us a picture. Thank you all for joining us at the Three Broomsticks. That brings us to the end of our episode today. Thanks so much to Dr. B. Groves for being on the show with us.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks both. It's been really fun chatting with you.
This has been so much fun just talking about the different ideas, and I've learned a lot. Remember, listeners, you can follow Bea on Twitter. I'm going to end today's episode with a quote from our vampire-like Severus Snape. And for those of you who are interested, we will try to put a link up to a picture that J.K. Rowling drew of Snape with his sort of with looking like a vampire, and so that you can see what that looked like. But here I'll end with our vampire like Severus Snape, who warned, "The dark arts are many, varied, ever-changing, and eternal. Fighting them is like fighting a many-headed monster, which, each time a neck is severed, sprouts a head even fiercer and cleverer than before. You are fighting that which is unfixed, mutating, indestructible." We here at Potterversity hope you will practice constant vigilance against the many-headed monsters out there, and don't forget your garlic!
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Towel, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.